The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Derek Varn is a reader at Zero Books, the host of Symptomatic Redness, and my nemesis. In this episode of Zero Squared, Derek and I debate the question of free speech as it relates to our mutual ill-defined Marxist socialism. It's Wednesday, February 13th, 2019, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. This is part of a two-part conversation and is available for free. The second half of this conversation will be available to our Patreon supporters next week. Patreon supporters get access to two podcasts every week, Symptomatic Redness and Zero Squared. But if you're listening for free, you'll always be able to access one or the other podcast each week. I hope you enjoy them. The music you're listening to right now is an 8-bit version of Chopin's Nocturne. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Derek Varn and I supposedly debate the issue of free speech. How would you define our differences on the issue of free speech? What's your position? And then I'll let you steel man my position.
So my position is that free speech is important, but also usually... Let me to really articulate it, because I've been thinking about it a lot. My position is free speech is actually probably not as important as people think, but it's vital to have. So I mean, that's a strange way to parse it. But I don't actually think it matters for things like figuring out truth claims unless you take it away. And I would say that your position is it used to be closer to like later John Stuart Mill, where you see free speech as part of the greater discourse, and the greater discourse is necessary to parsing out truth claims. And whereas I think, you know, one of the things of free speech is actually not just about truth claims, cause sometimes I think it's irrelevant to that, but like I think free speech actually not only stifles creativity, I mean, the lack of free speech not only stifles creativity, but also makes it harder to identify people who you're actually opposed to. So, I mean, in some ways, those aren't really that different. But I remember when we argued about this, I said that I just didn't believe in Mill's assertion that it would lead us to truth, because I still kind of don't think so. I just think that taking it away will almost always lead us to falsehood, which is it's a fine point distinction, but it's one of those things that seemed to, in the moment that we were arguing about it, seemed to get hackles up. And it does relate to this Enlightenment project stuff, because it is where my skepticism of the Enlightenment, the negative side of the dialectic, plays out a little more, because I see debates and speech mostly to be performed performatively, and they're not really actually about truth claims. And I don't even think you would necessarily disagree with that. But I also think that the way free speech has been framed in America has been completely disingenuous.
Well, when we get to that kind of empirical claim in a minute, but I want to kind of debate this bit about John Stuart Mill's, because I think there's something important, maybe philosophically, that I hadn't noticed before until you just articulated your difference, or the way you would think of your position being different than mine. And I think it has to do with a definition of truth more than it has to do with free speech. Like, if you believe that what truth is are claims that correlate to an empirical reality,
then you will need to hold on to free speech in order for us to, over time, in a dialectical way, approximate true claims that correlate to reality.
Right.
That's sort of the John Stuart Mill's approach to defending free speech. But if you could have a different understanding of truth, one that wasn't based on a correlation, then you might be able to argue maybe against Mills, but not against free speech like you were doing.
Yeah, so I think that actually is an insightful difference, because I tend to think correlational statements about truths are always provisional in a way that debate won't solve. Kind of like, I think if it's actually similar to like when Marx talks about human nature, he only mentions it like twice. When he talks about human nature, is like understanding dog nature. And how would you understand dogs? Is you would watch them in their natural environment being dogs. So you would understand what it means to be a dog, that that's their dog being. You have to do the same thing with people. But with people, more than dogs, although in some cases even with dogs, they are mediated by the historical circumstances in such a way that being able to disentangle what is innate and what is contingent is almost impossible to do.
I mean, now we're getting kind of into, I think, at least in my head, I'm getting into pretty deep philosophical questions. You know, the first thing that comes to mind for me is the way in which our situatedness in the world is, I'm thinking of it in Freudian terms now, castrated.
The idea is that we can never stand outside of human conversation and talk about reality as it is, or truth as it is. We never come into contact with naked truth. All we have is our conversation and our tools of augmenting our conversation, scientific instruments and otherwise. And all we really have, the currency of truth, is whatever successfully passes muster in a conversation. So I say something that I think is true, and it seems to work for you. We have a similar, we're playing a similar language game, and some people disagree, they criticize what we are claiming to be true, and we go back and forth. And all we ever have is this kind of ever-expanding horizon line of successful conversations that allow us to do things technologically that are very persuasive. So as you say, we can build hydrogen bombs. And so the conversation about the structure of the atom, at the very least, the conversation about the amount of energy hidden in the otherwise nebulous structure of an atom, that becomes, you know, very well grounded in facts that we all can agree are intersubjectively true.
Yeah, well, that seems to weaken the claim that it's just within language, you know, which is kind of a postmodern claim too, because it's very difficult for me to believe that the hydrogen bomb is what it is just because we agree what it is in conversation. You know, it immediately reflects a world outside of, now that outside of language, that doesn't mean we get permanent and omniscient access to that world, but it's more than language as far as, so maybe I'm misunderstanding Rorty or
I think you are understanding him. He will say that, again, all we ever have is our effort to organize the way the world seems to us. It does connect with postmodernism in a way that is decidedly unhelpful. And Rorty was a fan of Derrida and Foucault. And, you know, I remember walking out of Derrida's lecture at Stanford. I literally had to climb over the bodies of the credulous who were sitting in the aisles listening to the great man speak. And he didn't speak a single intelligible sentence, as far as I recall.
Well, that's obviously just because you don't have the profundity to understand, a postmodern French neo-Marxist intellectual.
I don't.
We don't actually have any way to verify a claim as correlating with the real world. And in fact, any claim will always be alienated from the world that it's trying to describe. If it wasn't, then it simply would be the world, right? So the fact that, you know, a truth claim is always reductionist, a truth claim is always either symbolic or in some other way representative, these things make it so that we are not going to arrive at actuality through debate. And there's a structural gap in our understanding. And that gap, I mean, that's what Zizek is always on about, but I think it's also in Hegel. I don't think he's wrong in the way he interprets Hegel. That gap is maybe the point of contestation around that's political or it can be cultural. And it always involves a certain level or kind of violence. Whatever you do to overcome that gap can never quite be justified. So that means that free speech and the correlationist approach to truth claims are doomed to fail. So what then are we talking about? How is that gap? How do we hold off the moment where that gap just expands out and we have no ground at all? We're just in an abyss at that point. We have no recourse to truth whatsoever.
I mean, when most people talk about free speech, they're not actually trying to deal with it on an epistemological and ontological level. But as far as you go, as far as you and I go, I don't know. I think one of the differences in our philosophical and maybe temperamental even approach to these speech claims is that I have no problem with there being only relativistic approximations to ontological truth. And this seems to bug the shit out of you. To the point that, like, you find Berkeley somewhat convincing, and I'm like, okay. What interests me about the free speech debate is there's three variant things being debated, and people are moving kind of dishonestly between three different things: speech as discourse and dialectic as a means of truth, speech as a expression of agency, self, and also freedom of association, and speech as a political right, and as a way to enfranchise those who are disempowered. And those three things are tangentially related to each other. But if you really want to parse it down, those are completely separate arguments. So I'm not as interested as you are about speech as a means to truth, because if you look at a debate, for example, truth is hardly ever discovered in a debate. But, and this is where I'm sympathetic to your point about their necessity or whatever, is that usually there's a third factor, or if you want to talk about it in weirdo Hegelian terms, which you normally do, there's a negation of negation that happens in the audience. So someone's inspired to look past the two sides, presenting, you know, a kind of performative, you know, almost monologues at one another, which not is going to convince anyone, but maybe will convince someone to try to look beyond both or to investigate them in a way that would confirm one or the other. But the people who are doing the debating are almost never affected by it. So it becomes performative. But speech is not just about those debates. I mean, like, one of the things Marx points out, I mean, it's funny because people have finally gotten hip on the fact that you can't really use Marx to make anti-free speech debates, except for the intellectual dark web people who just claim to have read Marx and obviously haven't, or if they have, they're acting in really, really bad faith. But I mean, the first debates he got involved in after writing about Epicurus when he was a journalist was, you know, advocating for free speech in Germany. I mean, like. And one of the things he said is, one, you can't expect people to be mature if they can't hear everything. Two, don't you need to know who your enemies are? We need to know who the reactionaries actually are. And if you silence them, they can operate in secret. And three, he does make a less idealistic claim about the nature of speech and truth than Mill does. But that there are certain ideas that won't bubble up into the public for us to kind of adopt and tackle if you can't say them. And it's interesting to me right now because we live in a moment where the left is associated with the denial of free speech. But you know what? I was listening to Heterodox Academy the other day just to like be prepared for this. You know, they're related to the IDWs, right? But one of the things they said is that I found interesting is they said in the general world, it was more likely to be Republicans and conservatives who were censorious and limiting and operating on bad faith and ideologically unfair and didn't really want to deal with free speech, and that they had empirical study to prove this, but that it was inverted on college campuses. Like, so even they actually, interestingly enough, and I was the guy was Chris Martin, so he's not like one of the big guys, but he runs the, one of their podcasts, and he was like, even he was like, well, basically in your day-to-day field, left liberals are more honest than and more forgiving and more dialogic and discoursive than right-wingers, except on college campuses where they feel like where a certain specific subset of them feel like they have the power to censor because they have social power. And one of the things I've always found interesting about a lot of the counter free speech arguments that I think they were actually hitting on something, even though the principle they're arguing for is utterly wrong. But what they aren't wrong about is the way that free speech is often used as a wedge empowered debates that has nothing to do with speech. And I think that was the other, because there was kind of two variances when you and I were arguing about this online, where like, and it made our conversation about this muddled, because in one sense we were arguing this ontological epistemological question, and in another sense I was like, look, the funny thing is almost nobody actually believes in speech in practice. Like, everybody says they do, but what they actually mean is, may my side talk, and then when I get to talk, I can change society by limiting who else can talk. And I actually found this funny because I'm like, they're empowering the speech that they don't think – that on one level, they're saying it doesn't matter so we can censor it. And on another level, they seem to think everything's determined by it, which is why we should censor it.
It's funny. I am not immune to this. I mean, like, on our Facebook and – YouTube channels, I will kick people off for being what I consider to be shits.
Yeah, I called you out on that privately.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, I don't even think you're wrong for doing that entirely, because. Right.
But it's also, when I do it, I do it in a completely unprincipled way. Like, I could not defend how I do it, because I don't do it based on a list of rules or even decorum. I just do it based on whether or not someone has pissed me off personally. And so there's clearly just I'm a little petty tyrant when it comes to this stuff, I guess, which is not good, I suppose. But I somehow knowing that it's not good and it's inconsistent has not changed my behavior one bit on that front. I'm not sure what that's about.
Interestingly, it has changed mine, but because okay. I used to do this too, and now I don't. I rarely ever kick people off unless they are cruel to someone else.
Look, I just kicked someone off who said that we needed to kill 60% of the population in order to have a revolution. To me, that was like, okay, you're clearly either a sociopath or some sort of a troll. And so,
well, I mean, you know what, though, that's a common position amongst left communists and even amongst Marxist Leninists sometimes.
That you have to kill more than half the population in order to have a revolution?
Yes.
What the fuck? Look, have I missed this one?
Well, the thing is, I always laughed at you at the pettiness of your criterion. And this is not to call you out. Because what I would find funny is, like, Marxist, like, Leninist, Stalinist, primitivist would be – and, like, right-wingers and liberals would be on your roll. But because they didn't attack you passionately as people who were actually politically closer to you, you didn't ban them. And it wasn't because of what they actually advocated, because often when they advocate something like that, you're, like, horrified. And I'm like, yeah, but I knew they thought that. Like, you know, maybe you should listen to the subtext of what they're saying.
Well, primitivists are a different story. They're not saying outright we should execute people.
No. They're saying that 80 to 99% of the population should die, but it should be passively as opposed to actively. Usually, although some of them do flip over into active mode.
Right.
So,
right. I don't know. They don't strike me as serious enough to be worried about, but not very close to
me
either.
I'll be honest with you. Like, the Marxist-Leninists don't strike me as seriously enough to be worried about. But guess what? They are closer to us than primitivists are.
Yeah, right. So, that's like, what bugs me, is that they take up the mantle of Marx and claim that there needs to be genocide in order to create that is a revolution.
Not even like genocide. That's just one people, like, pretty much democide. Like,
right.
I mean, like, but yeah, it's not like the abolishment of a class position. Like, no, we would literally have to kill all these people and then anyone subordinate to them. And then half of the working class because they are reactionary. And then there's a certain kind of left communist who doesn't say we need to actively kill them, but we need to let capitalism collapse. So it'll kill them too. And then we can just take over. Like, these are all positions that are actually held. I know them because I don't censor people. I know what the right wing is doing because I don't censor people.
Right.
But it's hard. It is hard not to do that. And the other thing is, and this is where I am sympathetic to a lot of like liberals or whatever, I don't think it's wrong to get those people out of your life if you're not using political means to do so. What has gotten much more difficult for us to deal with is the way that liberality has handled this contradiction in the past, all right, the way that liberal polities have handled this contradiction in the past is that they have set up a very strict demarcation between private and public speech. If you look at, the way like Adorno talks about it is actually flipped. We talked about this before, but they have a very strict demarcation between
Kant too, flipped.
Yeah.
It. Yeah.
But they have a very strict demarcation between private and public speech. Public speech and liberal sense is never censored. Private speech, you're totally can censor. The issue is that our stage of development, because of the way capitalism has subsisisted and I am going to use neoliberalism here, but I'm going to use it correctly. And it's specific neoliberal epoch where the governments create markets and create private things, but they're actually using them to regulate public things that are tied to the government directly. That line is really thin. So one of the things that the Democrats have liked to do that I have not been fond of is use legitimate libel laws and legitimate like false information laws to then censor selectively people who spread false information by putting pressure on private companies to do so by threat of regulation that they know if they actually did would probably be unconstitutional in the United States. But also these are transnational orders, so like it's not necessarily unconstitutional in the EU or in the UK. Therefore, these things can work in tandem to scare these private entities into enforcing public will. And I've noticed even leftists becoming okay with that. Now, that's terrifying, but it's a contradiction about the particular state of development we're in, because the clear line between public and private is been eroded.
Because when you have a thought, you can tweet it out.
Right. And a tweet, it's a private platform but you need that private platform to have a public life right now. If you are completely cut off from social media, you might be psychologically more healthy, frankly. But there's like many things you can't do, including like any kind of like you and I, media jobs. I would love to be able to shut my Facebook down. I can't. Why? Because I could not promote the artistic and social endeavors I do. Like not just it, like hardly at all, particularly with the way they've rewritten the algorithm. So you pretty much have to stay inside. It's written that way. So that demarcation between public and private, it's much, much thinner. It's been – but it's not just the internet that did it. That's been happening since cable. And honestly, when we had moral panics and stuff in the past, we were also relied on that distinction and blurred it. So like you know, whenever the government wanted to like plot down a decency code and it was made unconstitutional, well, it would just put pressures on private organizations to do it themselves under the threat that maybe they figure a way about this constitutional ban and then regulate you. Or they figure a way to do it over interstate commerce, like they did with non-cable broadcast medium, because it's on public airwaves and it's thus you can regulate it under commerce regulations and stuff. So they found ways around free
now,
speech.
Let's just be clear about what the problem is here about regulating the public speech through the state. I mean, because it's not actually as clear as we think, because as we've already demonstrated, there are like three different values that are all contained under the rubric of free speech. There's there's the claim that for basically, let's call it the claim for academic freedom or the pursuit of truth, right? I mean, then there's the freedom of association and
freedom of conscience, which is related.
Right. And freedom of conscience. And then there's the freedom of expression, personal expression of, is there another one that you mentioned?
Those are at least the three. I mean, and the funny thing is people innately know about the middle one, but never talk about it. So like freedom of conscience and freedom of association is something that has messed everybody up right now. I mean, like, because freedom of association, because of the contradictions in liberal discourse, in particular racist period, was used to like justify, you know, private segregation and stuff like that. And so that was deliberately weakened for some groups under the idea of like public liberty. But the thing is, and I'm going to, you know, go out on a limb and agree with like most of the liberal world and say that wasn't a bad thing. Right. But there is a flip side, an inverted, you know, we think dialectically here, there's a pernicious effect of that good thing where it can be used for other means that no one thought about. And, it, you know, conservatives have long since learned how to weaponize this, but just in general, it can be used that way. So if, you know, you have a hard time – I'll give you an example right now. So they penalized a bunch of kids for citing Ben Shapiro because Ben Shapiro is a white supremacist.
Yeah, this is where we're headed towards in this conversation. Go ahead.
And neither one of us like it, like, because we don't want to defend Ben Shapiro.
No. And not only that, I don't feel like this is – I feel like this is one of those tempest in teapot situations, because it's like a high school debate.
It totally is, except that at a different level, those high school debates are becoming determinative for other social policy. And there are states, and the United States is not one of them, where some of these theories that are come up with the United States about limited, you know, about hate, about
hate speech and stuff. Yeah.
And systemic violence. Now, we don't have hate speech laws, but we do have like hate speech. Speech becomes hate speech as it's punishable when combined with other crimes. Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's not punishable in and of itself, but it can be an included factor in dealing with crimes. But we like hate speech codes or something like you can privately have but not publicly have. But I've never been entirely comfortable with them because what's missed is here is the friend in it. Like, I'm going to sound like Carl Smith, but like people use this cynically with a friend enemy distinction. And there's a reactionary quote who I can't remember the source of it right now, and I don't want to look it up while I'm on the phone with you. So there's a reactionary quote saying, "When liberals are in power, we demand free speech because it is their principle. When we are in power, we suppress free speech because it is ours."
Right.
I know conservatives who actually who say that in private circles, and I've seen, and I maybe even be Carl Smith, but I don't think so. But it's that friend enemy distinction, like we're using the enemy's liberality against them explicitly, and then we totally intend to suppress it as soon as we've used it ourselves.
Well, let's go back to this high school debate, because what happened there was that they disqualified one team based on the quotes that they who they had cited. They had cited bad people, Jordan Peterson and Ben Shapiro, and therefore they were disqualified because they were just to cite them was a kind of hate speech.
Right.
White supremacists kind of hate speech.
It's frankly silly.
Yeah, it's asinine.
If those two people are white supremacists, and you know, they might be softly or tacitly, but then like all the 20th century is, in which case you can't cite anybody really. And if they're not, that looks blatantly like you're just suppressing an argument off of who said it and not dealing with what it is. And that's just a bad faith.
You should be able to cite anyone, though. I'm going to say you should be able to cite Hitler and it shouldn't disqualify you, or certainly like someone like Heidegger, and it shouldn't disqualify your side.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I obviously completely agree with that. I mean, like the logic, it doesn't really matter. It's a bad call in this sense, but it does tell you that people in educational and thus administrative institutions are internalizing an attitude that source is more important than saying, and that the accusation of a bad position is itself. With, I mean, like in the case of those two, like, there are some good arguments that, I mean, that those two hold very, you know, asinine positions, some of which I would say are maybe tacitly or structurally racist, but explicit white supremacy is another thing.
Right. And we know what that is these days, and we can tell the difference. But the, even let's putting that question aside, what I wonder about is, I mean, if I were going to put on my kind of middle of the road conservative what's going on in America hat and chime in here, I would say, what is this telling us about the state of education when kids aren't being taught in a debate class basic rules of logic and discourse, when the distinction between rhetoric and social pressure and logic and reason has completely been lost, even on in a formal setting?
Right.
That's maybe what would be troubling to me as a parent.
Oh, it's troubling. It's troubling to me as a Marxist. I'm not going to lie. I mean, like, the idea of moral heroes and villains that have infected our debate about speech has been pernicious. But I'm actually going to do a turn that I think you might do too, honestly, and say, the right wing discourse about this is part of why that's happened. Now, I actually find myself in a really precarious position because I agree with some of their critiques of the way, particularly in the last 10 years, that public-private distinction has been abused on campuses. I actually think there is some, although not as much, truth to it, particularly on elite campuses, particularly when involving petty bourgeois. And I have some Marxist friends of mine who say, look, this is one faction of like progressive petty bourgeois people fighting a regressive petty bourgeois, but it's really their fight. Like, it doesn't really affect everybody else. And I kind of think that's partly true. But what I'm noticing is because it infects public education, it doesn't stay there. So this kind of stuff has been getting tit for tat both ways for a while. I mean, I don't want to out a friend of mine, but a friend of mine basically lost their job at a public institution for a conservative doing something to her on these grounds, like using safe spaces and being made to feel unsafe as a conservative. And that's claiming to be censored. Yep, got her fired. Lost her job. They were able to censor a professor by claiming that they felt hostile work censoring. Which is what I've been telling people about this. This is the other thing you and I disagree with. It's like most of my stuff is partly tactical, where I'm like, what you're doing here is going to hurt you tactically. Like, it's stupid tactically. The people who you think you're going to go actually have more social power than you. And so as soon as you're outside of these spheres where you're kind of shut off, they're going to crush you with this. And they are.
Yeah, that. But see, I don't disagree with that argument.
You just don't think
all.
It's relevant.
I do think it's relevant. I just don't think it's strong enough. Like, I think that we need to have a commitment to free speech that goes beyond that, because Because tactical questions are always thorny, and also when you're only acting tactically, then you risk, I guess, just being a hypocrite or risk being completely self-serving. I mean, that's just right. Not good enough. We really should stand for I know I'm going to sound very liberal here, but we should stand for some key concepts that we hold to be more important than even tactical advantage in a particular moment.
So your critique of that's something I've been thinking about myself, because when I make the tactical argument, it makes it sound like I agree that this is still a friend-enemy distinction and it's just about the amount of power we have. But I actually do think, in principle, we should be okay with freedom of conscience and freedom of association, which, I'm going to be honest, is weirdly controversial amongst Marxist. I don't know why it's controversial. Well, I do know why, actually, if I'm really because the Bolshevik banning of factions cuts against freedom of conscience, even though Lenin invoked it all the time. Like, that was actually part of how they justified kicking people out of the party. But if you which is easy to reconcile until you start banning factions. And if you say that freedom of association and freedom of conscience is not allowable because it leads to factionation, you're basically saying two principles that even Lenin was vocally for before 1921 and suppressed, according to his diaries, only because of the Civil War, are like a norm because we're kind of always at civil war. Like, which is kind of nutty, but that's kind of the argument. And that, like, freedom of conscience and freedom of association may be something we can have under communism, but it can only be formal now. Therefore, we shouldn't have it. And you know what? You know, even Zizek, I don't have this quite as sanguine a view on Zizek as you do, but he even picks up that, like, you know, some merely formal liberties are actually pretty worth fighting for.
Right. Although he's not as very, I don't think he's as, he's not any kind of a free speech absolutist, Zizek.
Well, I don't know what free speech absolutism is outside of the reason why I say this right now is, like you said, in your personal life, you're kind of a petty tyrant on this. And, and since the public-private distinction is so muddled right now, and liberals and leftists have both fallen back on this, like, one of my friends, and they made a position I actually agreed with, that I was like, look, you know, Facebook and PayPal and whoever, they have every right to kick Alex Jones off. The only way they wouldn't is if we nationalize them and socialize them. But then if we actually did that, we actually couldn't kick a lot of these people off. And this is actually where the tensions have been so heightened and state institutions, because a lot of these rules they use at private institutions have been attempted at state ones, but the states really don't have that power. Like, states can't discriminate. State institutions can't discriminate on ideological grounds. Like, it's actually constitutionally settled. So they can discriminate on some moral ones, and the issue becomes, like, what are those lines? And to be fair, the right wing has been very good at instrumentalizing this. As you realize this, you and I talked about this, like, they're just very good at taking that problem and weaponizing it to get themselves access to institutions, to silence people they don't like. As I told you today, to literally get professors fired.
Right. So my question is, when we run up against that problem, or the opposite, where we run up against this problem where, in what should be a strictly formal debate, we're finding the rules of discourse kind of dissolving and rules of rhetoric taking their place. What is the Marxist to do in response to that? I mean, one of the things I've tended to do is try to, you know, elaborate and distinguish, like, what a principal position would be in theory, even as I, you know, in practice operate like a petty tyrant. But obviously, maybe that's not good enough. But I think it's not, I don't think it's completely, I think it's necessary to do, but I don't know if that may not be good enough. Maybe the next step after I understand and articulate my position would be to then try to see if I can concretize it. But what would you say a good approach would be in this moment to the question of free speech for the
left? I've actually really been struggling with this myself, because I do, as a broad principle, agree in freedom of conscience and freedom of association. Thus, I also believe that people should be able to explicitly express their freedom of conscience and freedom of association. And also, for tactical reasons, there's two principles at work here. They're not the same. I also like to know who the reactionaries are and how far their beliefs go. And I can only know that when they're not underground. And not only not underground, I hate to say this because this is where I part ways with a lot of liberals who kind of followed me up to here and a lot of leftists who followed me up to here. I also have to sometimes be civic with them so that they will admit things to me.
Yeah, I don't think that's a bad idea.
But a lot of people think that's nutty because, like, oh, you're condoning people who would kill me. I'm like, hey, I don't know that they're really actually out to kill you, but some of them are. I will grant you that. But wouldn't you like to know who they are? Like, if you just silence them, because the assumption that really goes by, and look, the assumption may not be socially unfounded for some groups. I'm not even going to lie, but the assumption is most of the public actually agrees with the hate mongers. So if they express it, it's going to make everybody feel safe to hate on me. But the assumption is not. And I literally pointed this out to somebody who's yelling at me about, like, you know, I said, like, imagine people's other worldviews for a second. They're like, you're asking me to imagine Trump pulling apart children from. And I'm like, how do you know I'm not asking the Trumpist to imagine your? Why do you always assume that this cuss against you? Like, and that, this is where I'm going to say something that seems unrelated. The left needs to have more resilience across the board. It needs to be willing to, like, to take some hits in order to win, like, to win tactically, and to let people out themselves. I mean, one of the tragic truths about Charlottesville, and this is going to seem unrelated, but, like, the discrediting of the alt-right comes from the fact they were allowed to operate, and that did cost someone their life, and it would be better if it didn't happen. I'm not saying, but it also like turned the tide of even moderate conservative opinion against them.
Do you think that if she hadn't died, that event would have had the same
effect? Sadly, no.
Regardless,
I think it would have had some. I think it would have had a lot of negative effect regardless, but I don't think it would have been as much. And unfortunately, this is why I argue with a lot of Antifa, because they're like, we chased them out, we made them afraid. I'm like, you made them afraid only because what they did made it clear that you were the less bad party to people who were otherwise skeptical of both sides. Like, and now when you go, when even like 15 of those guys come out, 100,000 people come out with counter protest. Like, that's great.
Right.
I'm not knocking it, but that's not because of like your street violence actions. It's because of the clear consequences of them and the asymmetry of force. Because, you know, even if you guys occasionally hit some innocent people in MAGA hats over the head for no real reason, you've never, like, ran anyone down with a car. Like, yeah. I have been told that's one of the most reactionary positions I hold. You know, that so I just.
Why? What's reactionary about that?
Because it's like you're denying our power and agency. And I'm like, no, I'm saying that things are socially larger than you.
Yeah, and why is it reactionary to deny someone's power and agency if the truth is they don't have the agency and power that they think they have? I mean, that's
reactionary. Just becomes I only like some ruthless criticism when it's not aimed at me,
right?
Like, and here's the thing: like, I actually softened. The funny thing is that Charlottesville changed a lot of my opinions about anti-fascism. Like, but the basic thing became like, yeah, but if at the end of the day, if we're honest, it wasn't, you know, politicized explicit Antifa that did it on its own. It was the fact that the ugly truth of the situation made Antifa appealing.
Right.
Like, though, and that's not the same thing as like we just beat them in the streets and they went away, because you kind of didn't.
No, you lost in the streets.
Right. And you know,
that's the weird thing, is that it was actually what would have been even more effective would have been if there had been no Antifa and that had happened.
Right. But it's highly unlikely that. Well, anyway, I mean,
it wouldn't have necessarily happened. The guy wouldn't have run anybody over. I mean, but it's a very horrible calculus that we're running here, right?
Yeah.
But that's the thing, is that
and we this is are the danger
in that kind of moment.
Right? And also, this is a danger of this is to kind of support. I'm going to do the Rogerian thing and grant you a major premise, since we're technically debating, I guess. Your point about being totally instrumental about this is exactly why, like, we shouldn't be instrumental. This right here is because, like, if I was totally instrumental, I would be like, well, why don't we just have more people jump in front of cars and die? Like, because it's pretty effective. Well, the thing is, A, it wouldn't be as effective as it happened on Sam. But B, like, in fact, it has happened a couple times since then. I don't think anybody got killed. But, like, it's happened since then, and it didn't have the same effect. But two, there are principled reasons, like, where you just don't do that, where you're just like, I'm not, you know, it's not worth it.
The ends don't justify the means.
Right. There really is a limit to that. They're like, all the diehard Marxist Leninists will say that you and I are petit bourgeois liberals or something, because we will say the ends don't justify the means, but in some cases they really don't. And sometimes the means destroy the ends possibility.
Right. That's the real truth of it. But let's talk about an actual petite bourgeois liberal, because I was fascinated to kind of stumble upon Fukuyama's position on free speech.
Okay.
And Fukuyama's position on politics generally. I started listening to his book, Political Order and Political Decay. I think